The annual Meriden Daffodil Festival comes to at the end of the month. They're doing their tag sale weekend, April 23rd. The actual festival is April 30th and May 1st. Rick Susio joins us on the line. Rick, thanks so much for being here to talk about my favorite festival, the Meriden Daffodil Festival.
Well, I'm glad to hear that it's your favorite festival, and thanks for having me on the line. And I'll tell you what, we got a lot to talk about because we've been off for 2 years, and we plan on coming back strong, and we want everybody to spread the word that we're back, and we've got something on the table for everyone.
All right, let's start off with the tag sale weekend, because that's huge, too. What do people need to know about the tag sale weekend? And people can still become tag sale vendors, and we'll get into that, too, with the festival, the food vendors, that there's still opportunities for people to join, yes?
Correct. We still have plenty of opportunity for people to join. The tag sale is under our large tent. It's the biggest tag sale that we know of in Connecticut. And, you know, it's everything from, you know, people cleaning out their houses for garages for the spring cleaning to some professional tag sailors that have displays. And that is Saturday, April 23rd, rain or shine, because we are under the big tent. And we are still accepting applications, and then go visit us at daffodilfest.com and click on the events page and go to the tag sale, and there's the application there. And there's something there for everybody. It goes from 9 until 2 that day. There will also be food concessions available. Our rides will also be available, weather permitting. And that those days, we do allow people to drive and park in the Hubbard Park,
oh, cool,
the location of the festival, which normally during the festival the following weekend we will not allow, but that weekend we do. And it's some of the stuff that's in there is so eclectic, it's great. And again, after 2 years of not being able to have it, it'll be interesting to see what people show up with.
You know, a lot of people love tag sales, and I think that's definitely one of those things that you can go out there, and again, there are great things to find. Hubbard Park in Meriden is such a fun place, again, weather permitting. Let's assume the good weather, of course. April, very well known for its showers. Rick just dropped off the line for a minute. We're going to get him right back on here because we're going to talk a little bit more about the Meriden Daffodil Festival. I just got a text. Are there going to be food trucks there? I'm going to ask Rick that as soon as we get back. I do know there's going to be a ton of really great vendors there. And there's going to be a lot of musical entertainment. If you have a band, you can actually get booked for the Meriden Daffodil Festival, again, by visiting the website. Rick is back with us. Awesome, Rick. I bought us a minute.
Not sure what happened here. I'm sorry about that. So I went through the tag sale. I think we got all of that in before I was cut off.
Yep.
And then I was starting to move on to the following day, that Sunday, we're going to have a Daffodil Dash fun run at the park. As well as new this year, we'll be partnering with the Meriden Historical Society. They've got a new location in downtown Meriden that they're going to be hosting an open house at. So that'll be on the 24th of April. And again, information can be found on our website, which I heard you plugging. So,
and I will continue to plug that, Rick.
Thank you.
Of course.
That's the pre-weekend festivities. And again, rides will be available weather permitting.
My mom lives over by the mall, Rick. She just texted me. She said, is there going to be food trucks or is it just going to be vendors?
At the tag sale, it will just be one food concession area,
okay,
set up. But at the festival the following weekend, we will have our typical nonprofits in there selling everything from fried dough to empanadas and coffee to fresh squeezed lemonade and Belgium waffles and all the typical fair food that following weekend. And if your mom lives over there by there, by the Westfield, by the Meriden Mall, she can actually get a shuttle bus right from that location. We run our shuttle buses for the festival weekend. There is no parking in the park. We run free shuttles from Platt High School, which is 220 Coe Avenue, Lincoln Middle School, which is right next to it, and Wilcox, which is also on the same strip, as well as we run them from the Meriden Mall location. And also that is where our disability parking is. We have special shuttles that bring people from the Meriden Mall location on the Lewis Avenue, but you'd enter from the Chamberlain Highway side. And again, those are free parking, free shuttles. There's no admission to the festival. And we have free entertainment on three separate stages. We have everything from this year. We've got a Van Halen tribute band, the Eagles Experience. We've got Zydeco music, Motown music, country and Western, not to mention bluegrass also, steel drums, mariachi bands. So there's going to be some kind of music, and our schedule's up on the website. And then we also have our family entertainment and children's entertainment with Wild World of Animals and Mike Stidley's mountain bike stunt show and jugglers. And we'll have Sunday is dedicated to local performances from local performing arts and dance studios and different types of lab, creative space for the arts are all going to be going on. That's Sunday mostly. We've switched venues for that type of thing. And then we have our Theater of the Trees, where we have meet and greets with Disney characters from Encino, Maribel, Isabella, Bruno, Princess Ariel, plus two fan favorites, Baby Shark and Paw Patrol. We'll have kids karaoke. We'll have a dance party. So really, there is something for everybody. And so far, everything I've mentioned is for free. And then we hope that while you are there, you come and you sample some of the great food from our nonprofits and support them. They've been, had two very difficult years struggling, raising funds, and we haven't been able to help them out, but we're back this year and we're hoping that, you know, we get some good weather. And for many of these groups, it's their largest fundraiser of the year, and they've got hot dogs, hamburgers, steamed cheeseburgers, which is one of Meriden's favorite and famous
items. Rick, you know what? Hang on one second. We got to take a quick break. I want to dive in a little bit more because there's so many great things about Meriden. Obviously, steamed cheeseburgers being one of them. And again, for me, this whole festival in general, and I'm very excited. I'm actually going to be doing some MC work on the musical stage, thanks to our buddy Dan Merzik. Who's always out there pushing the city of Meriden and asked me to hook it up. And, of course, I had to say yes. So, Rick, we're going to take a quick break. We'll do traffic and weather on the sixes, do a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Rick Susio talking about the 2022 Meriden Daffodil Festival on Connecticut Today on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM. I'm Joe Aguirre in for Paul Pacelli here on Connecticut Today. Thanks so much for joining us. We're on the line with Rick Susio. We're talking about the Meriden Daffodil Festival. Their tag sale weekend is April 23rd. The festival weekend, April 30th and May 1st. 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday. The festival on Sunday is from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. And as you mentioned, Rick, and I love this, that there's no admission fee to get into the Daffodil Festival. And a couple other things. You can bring your own food if you just want to go. And I mean, you're encouraged, obviously, to go and indulge the vendors. But we want people to be out there at the Daffodil Festival. No dogs. No bikes or skateboards, strollers and wheelchairs, obviously okay. And cash. Got to have cash in the park, yes?
Yes, we will have ATMs on site, but it's always good to show up with your own cash. We do also have the craft fair, and some of the crafters will be accepting credit cards for purchases there, and there'll be a wide array of very nice handcrafted items as well as some gourmet food items that will be for sale in that area. And they do take credit cards, and we will have the ATMs, but, you know, as they say, cash is king.
Rick Susio joining us, talking about the Meriden Daffodil Festival. This 32nd annual Daffodils on Parade is Saturday, 11:30 a.m. I love this year's theme is Thank You All. You want to tell us a little bit about the Daffodils on Parade?
Yes. You know, the parade really has taken on a life of its own. Originally, it was just some local school groups and Little League groups and Boys and Girls Club and, you know, Girls Inc. But now, you know, we have several marching bands. We have antique vehicles. We have the Shriners. But we still also have a lot of those hometown organizations. And as you said, you know, that is going to be on Saturday. Begins at 11:30, and it will end in the park. It will start up West Main Street and come down and into the park and go through the park. And yes, you know, after 2 years of being off and all that our first responders and our healthcare professionals have done, as well as just people within the community stepping up to help out people, we figured that it was appropriate to have a theme of just thank you all. Thanks for everybody for hopefully the lights at the end of the tunnel. I don't think this is ever going to go away, but the worst is behind us, and we want to thank all those who got through, and our teachers and educators who had to deal with the students online, and, you know, just so many people did so much. So we want to make sure that everybody knows that they're appreciated, and that's why thank you all, our government leaders who got us through it. So that was the theme that we all agreed on. Once the parade coordinators, Jane and Donna, came up with it, we thought it was a great idea. And the other big news there is we're going to have Meriden's own Dr. Cardona, the Secretary of Education, will
Very
be
cool.
our Grand Marshal. We actually had chosen him to be Grand Marshal 2 years ago when he was the State Education Commissioner, and unfortunately we had to postpone. And in the meantime, he got a promotion. And, you know, it makes our life a little bit difficult because now we got to deal with Secret Service. Before, we just had to deal with state troopers, but it's an honor that's well-deserved. He's grown up going to the festival. His family's grown up going to the festival. His father has been a big part of the festival, performing at it when he was a police officer. Mm-hmm. He worked at it. He's been our Grand Marshal in the past, so it's very fitting that we should honor one of Meriden's brightest stars for an accomplishment well-deserved, and we're excited that he's going to be joining us for the parade, as well as some local dignitaries and local personalities, and most importantly, all those youth groups. So we're really looking forward to that.
The Crafts by the Lake Craft Fair, New England's most beautiful craft fair, is happening Saturday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We got about 3 more minutes, Rick, if you want to plug away the craft fair.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I mean, there's going to be everything there that you can imagine. Homemade candles, jewelry, gourmet food items. There'll be stuff for your pets, stuff for your garden, stuff for your house. You know, something for everyone. There'll be stuff for the kids, you know, those water balloon yo-yos and some of the other handmade toys. And, you know, it is a beautiful spot. It's right on the pond. And, you know, we give them a whole corner. And it's been very well attended in the past. And, you know, everybody seems to always be walking around with something that they've purchased up there. And I know for almost my daughter's entire life, it's the highlight of the festival. You know, we are a volunteer organization. The committee, including you mentioned Dan, put a ton of hours in year round. And when it comes to festival time, 2 weeks worth of craziness. But my daughter, Ashley, and I, and this will be the first year she's not at the festival because she's studying abroad in Italy, she's always made a point of grabbing me at some point Sunday, and we go shopping up there, and we get some cookies or fudge and some, you know, oil or vinegar, and it's our special time together. And I think a lot of parents enjoy that time with their kids going through the craft fair, because there is something there for everyone. So we're hoping that, you know, the weather's good. That's the most important thing at this point. And we'll hope that, you know, we haven't forgotten too much in the last 2 years, and that we make sure that we can still pull this thing off. The city of Meriden is a wonderful partner with us. They really supply us with some services to make sure that it's a safe festival from a public safety point of view. And this year they're working with us hand in hand to make sure that from a health perspective, it's also a state festival. So it'll be interesting. Everybody's excited on the committee. The buzz in the community is great. You know, after 2 years, it'll be exciting to see everybody back. And, you know, usually when we're at an annual festival, there's times where you run into old neighbors and old friends, and people will come back from college for this and come back and make it a, you know, a long weekend to come back and see family and friends. Now, after, you know, 2 years of not having, it'll be interesting to see faces that, you know, we haven't run into out and about in the community.
You are so right, Rick. I am really looking forward to the Meriden Daffodil Festival and the Tag Sale Weekend. As we mentioned, Tag Sale Weekend, April 23rd. Festival Weekend, April 30th through May 1st. Rick, I'll be looking for you at that festival. Maybe we'll go grab a steamed cheeseburger.
I'd like that. And thank you again for your time. And I look forward to seeing you. And this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you giving us your forum. I know you got a lot of listeners out there. And for us just to be able to spread the word on this larger forum has been wonderful.
Well, it is absolutely my pleasure. I live in Weathersfield now, but, you know, I'll always be a Meriden boy. Celebrating 43 years, 600,001 plus daffodils. Visit daffodilfest.com. You can plan your visit. Rick Susio, thank you so much for joining us. Joining me on the line, former News Channel 8 reporter and anchor Brian Spiros. You covered the Fotis Doulos case, and you and I worked together at Connecticut School of Broadcasting. It used to give me all the insight of the case, and I thought, since I was going to be on this week, got to have you on, Brian. How you doing? And let's talk some Fotis.
I am doing great. It's been a while since I've talked about this case, but happy to be here with you and share whatever knowledge I can impart on the listeners out there.
So you were literally covering this thing every day, and at one point, you talked to me about you were near him, and you sort of has like an intoxicating presence about him, which I thought was a super interesting thing to say.
Yeah, so Fotis, and it's hard to talk about this because people will think it's bizarre, but for those of us who were around him and really immersed in the case, he had this kind of, the way he carried himself, and he had a little bit of an arrogance, but he was, you know, nice to all of us covering the story, believe it or not, and he just had this way about him that sort of, you know, you kind of just felt like he was this all-around great guy, and then suddenly you had to say, wait a minute, he's like, you know, the prime suspect in his wife's murder and disappearance. And so it was different from any other case I've ever been involved, because normally you're dealing with people who are mad that they're a prime suspect or they've been charged, but he was the exact opposite, which made it very difficult because you'd sit there and say, was he capable of doing this? Did he do this? And then you'd have to remind yourself, based on the evidence police have so far, It doesn't look good.
And so the evidence against him, I mean, again, I feel like you know the case better. You're not a judge or a jury here, but how solid of a case? Obviously, Fotis took his life. He couldn't have felt great about where things stood. From looking at the evidence and sort of the way things were playing out, how did you see that going?
You know, I mean, from the beginning, of course, you know, with stories now, as soon as they get out there, the court of public opinion sort of comes up with the verdict already. But police were really taking their time with this one. You know, I think it was a few days after Jennifer went missing, everyone was saying, why don't you just charge her husband, you know, her soon-to-be ex-husband with murder? But that's not the way the process works. Mm-hmm. There's a whole system we have to go through, and police were buttoned up about everything. And then when they had information, when they were ready to make sort of an arrest in whatever the charge was, that's when more stuff came to light. So they did a phenomenal job, I think, really investigating this and taking their time with the entire process. They were really building a solid case against him. You may remember, Joe, I mean, first it was they got him with the tampering of evidence because he was seen in Hartford on surveillance dumping those trash bags. Mm-hmm. And then it was months later that they really were able to charge him with murder when they kind of were able to pinpoint that he used his employee's truck allegedly to drive down to New Canaan, do what he had to do, and then come back to Farmington. And that's really, I think that was the biggest break in the case, when they were able to actually connect him in New Canaan at the time Jennifer went missing.
Now, last week, Michelle Traconis was in court trying to get some of these charges against her tossed. That did not go well. They did not do that. I'd like to get your take on that. We do have to take a quick break. Traffic and weather here on the Sixes. More with Brian Spiros, former reporter and anchor from News Channel 8 here on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM. I'm Joe Aguirre, in for Paul Pacelli on the line with former News 8 reporter and anchor Brian Spiros. We're talking about the Fotis Doulos case. And Brian, thanks for sitting through a quick break with me here. Michelle Traconis and Kent Mowinney, both charged with conspiracy to commit murder in connection with the case. She's also looking at charges like tampering with physical evidence and hindering a prosecution. Did you get a chance to be around Michelle? And like I said before the break, what sort of evidence did you see there?
So I, along with everyone else in the media, was only around her really when she would kind of go to and from court, when she would make her appearances. She was just very matter of fact and obviously wouldn't speak to anyone. But charges against her really kind of have to do with, possibly a little premeditated. I mean, we know that, according to police, that apparently there was a note or a letter in the house that Fotis and Michelle tried to come up with all of these alibi plans, that, you know, when they were questioned, they would have the same story. We know, according to police, they say that Michelle was in the vehicle with Fotis when he was dumping those items in Hartford that we later know had, you know, Jennifer's blood, DNA, some of her clothing, cleaning supplies in them as well. So it didn't obviously fare very well for her. Initially she kind of lied, saying that she was with Fotis that morning, and then later would reveal to the police that, you know, she wasn't with him and that he wasn't at the house and that Kent Mowinney was there. And he was also part of the alibi. And I believe he's the one who claimed that, you know, he was with Fotis at the house and they were on a telephone call with someone in Greece, meaning there's no way Fotis could have been in New Canaan, but police were obviously able to crack that and realize that none of it was true.
Yeah, it's funny. Not funny. I don't even know what the right word to say there. But, you know, in these situations, generally where somebody lies, your story's going to fall apart pretty quickly. I mean, if you're not where you say you're going to be, it's going to be hard to prove that. And if you were somewhere else, it's going to be much more easier for law enforcement, obviously, to track you down. Her attorney says that the truck is only shown stopping 3 times, not 30 times, as was asserted in the court filings. He says there's no video evidence of his client leaning out of the truck, which, implied that she was there to assist Fotis. The judge wasn't having it. Any errors in the filings he called inadvertent. It doesn't seem like Michelle Traconis is in a very good spot right now.
It doesn't. And, you know, one of the things that came up when we were covering it, and I can't remember where, but someone had mentioned that it wasn't uncommon for Fotis to actually dump things in Hartford so that he wasn't having to pay for dumpsters or disposal of stuff at his job sites, almost inferring that kind of she was just along for the ride for something that he used to normally do. Now, whether or not that's true, we don't know, but that's what, you know, we had heard through the grapevine was being claimed about all that. But yeah, it doesn't look good for her. at all. And then I was reading that, you know, Ken Mulwinney may now try to basically go against her if he goes to trial. So, you know, even though Fotis is no longer here, I have a feeling that this is really going to get messy once we start to go to trial. And this case, really, which has been put on hold, it seems, because of the pandemic, starts to proceed. People probably, you know, forgot all about it, but there still are two people who are facing charges for this.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Until I saw the update about a week ago, I, you know, sort of forgotten this was still an ongoing process. And again, as soon as I saw this, Brian, I immediately thought, I got to hit my man up. We got to go on air. We got to talk about this. I'm going to ask you a question, and obviously this is going to have to be you speculating, again, based off of what you know and what you've seen and what evidence you heard presented. But what is the working theory as far as how he laid out the trap? Did he do it there? Do they think he took her away from the home? Can you kind of lay that out for us?
So what police had always come out with when they charged him with murder was that, you know, he drove the employee's car down to New Canaan, and in the back of that truck, he had a bicycle. He parked the car at Waveney Park, got in the bike, rode it to Jennifer's house and was waiting for her. They know that some sort of attack happened at that house, which killed her or incapacitated her. I don't believe they were ever able to really say definitively that she left there and she was already dead, but based on the blood and the evidence, they feel that whatever happened to her was pretty horrific. And then drove her vehicle back to Waveney Park, left it there, and then put, you know, we don't know at that point what happened to her body. Was it in the truck? And we do know that at some point it must have been in the truck because there was blood. But was that from other evidence? That's where sort of everything kind of goes awry, because we don't know what happened to Jennifer after that. I remember reading at one point that they were able to track her cell phone, ping it from the house to Waveney Park, but then the phone went off. Meaning, was it Fotis or someone else realize her phone was on her? And, you know, they then shut it off. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what they had always theorized that had happened. But it's just baffling, because we always wondered, where did Jennifer end up? Did Fotis put her somewhere along the way back to Farmington, or was someone else involved who possibly met Fotis rather at Waveney Park and then disposed of the body that way? So that's where there's a lot of gray areas in all this. And police, you know, they've painstakingly been trying to figure all of that out.
It's such a crazy story. Obviously, these kinds of murders in Connecticut are few and far between. This thing was national news headlines. Were you there in court when, I mean, I think everybody was waiting for him in court the day he took his own life.
Yeah, I was not there that day. I had just so happened to be off. But yeah, he had to go for a hearing because he was at risk of having his bond revoked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was in court a week or two prior to that when the judge basically told him that there wasn't enough collateral to hold up the bond that a company had basically put forth for him. And there was a lot of panic at that point as to whether or not he was going to go back to jail. And the day he, you know, attempted suicide in the garage at the Farmington home, he was supposed to be in court. And there was the real possibility that day he was going to go back behind bars because the bond had basically fallen through. So I think a lot of people speculate that that's why he took his own life, because I think he knew what was coming. And, you know, this case, I still think about it often. And Joe, the one thing, no matter how people felt about everyone involved, at the end of the day, we have to remember that five children mm-hmm. lost their mom and their dad. They lost their entire world. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. And I wonder if they'll ever be able to have the closure of knowing where their mother ended up or where she is. It's just, it's gut wrenching.
It sure is. And a really good point, obviously, you know, those five kids, you know, nobody deserved any of this, but especially those five kids. And you're right. I mean, just devastating to their life. Brian, I really appreciate it. Great catching up with you. Thank you so much for joining us. Always, you were so insightful about this case. I appreciate you sharing it with the audience at WICC.
There is more to come with it. And it was my pleasure. Nice talking to you, Joe.
Awesome. Former News 8 reporter and anchor Brian Spiros. We'll definitely have him back as things progress in that case. Joining me on the line, and a big thank you to him. I know he's a very busy man. State Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff represents Norwalk and Darien. I know you were just on this station not too long ago. I think earlier in the week or last week, Bob.
Hey, Joe, how are you? Yeah, I was in I'm on Monday mornings with Melissa Sheketoff.
Oh, very cool. All right. So you're a real estate agent. I have my real estate license as well. And I've seen this story. Through March 16th, there were over 1,275 evictions projected to, at that pace, as many as 2,400 evictions would have come due at the end of this month. Is that something that you guys are looking at? Where are these people going to go? There's obviously very limited inventory in the first place with this real estate market.
Yeah, thank you. I know it's a huge issue for us and something we definitely want to tackle. I mean, I think first and foremost, through the coronavirus, we did everything we can to prevent foreclosures and evictions with moratorium and working to keep people in their homes the best that we could. We have the Night CP program, which is federally funded. Fortunately, that money has run out. Unless we get more funding from the federal government, it's going to be difficult to continue that. But I think that, you know, we're looking at every different possibility we can, because the market, as we know, is very tight. There's very little inventory out there. Rental prices have gone up. House prices have gone up. And we don't want to see families on the street. So, you know, the best thing we can do is to, you know, help hopefully mediate some of this and keep people in their homes and try to make landlords whole if we can, and then try and help people to catch up if they need to be caught up on things.
All right. I want to talk to you now about it went into effect today, the gasoline tax. My good buddy Russ Moore, and I know you know Russ, was on with me yesterday, and I obviously he's out of office. I said, Russ, is this an election year gimmick? And he hemmed and hawed for a second. He was like, yeah, this bipartisan, it kind of is. Is there, I mean, I paid $3.79 earlier today, which was a far cry right from where it was about a week ago. I don't know if that's even related to, or if this is just a natural price drop. I got to give you guys credit. I mean, I you have to do something, Bob. I understand that, right? And I think as I saw the numbers, this is going to be about $25 per car in savings. But at this point, honestly, right, anything helps.
Well, that's the whole thing. This is really going to help working families, middle income families throughout the entire state of Connecticut. Your $3.79 today is absolutely a result of the 25-cent. Reduction because per gallon reduction, because yesterday I looked at gas in Norwalk and it was $4.11. So all you gotta do is take 25 cents off of that and you're about, you know, at that number. And so, you know, I think that this is a good thing for families. There's always going to be cynics out there saying, oh, it's this or it's that. You know, every year there's an election in this country. We have 2-year terms as legislators. But what we know right now is that we know that families are suffering. It's very difficult when you're paying all this extra for gasoline and inflation and everything else. And so, you know, there's only so many tools in our toolbox to help with that. This is one of them. And frankly, you know, we're going to try and do everything we can with gas prices. But the other parts of the bill were sales tax free week coming up in April, right before Easter. That's going to be great for families to buy shoes or clothing under $100. Mm-hmm. And then there's free bus service the next 3 months. So, I mean, there's something in there for everybody, really. And again, I think the average person out on the street, like you just said, you know, you take whatever. And you're, you know, I think that's how the sentiment is out there. People are like, thank you for doing this. We know it's taking money away from the transportation fund, but there's a surplus in it right now because of higher gas prices. So we feel like we can do it and we can afford it. And so we're going to pass those savings along to the families in the state of Connecticut.
You know, most polls I see, people don't blame Joe Biden for gas prices being as high as they are. People understand supply and demand, futures, commodities, an invasion in Ukraine and how that all impacts things. Here's the thing. You know, this is how midterm elections go. They never go well for the incumbent party. And so I've been saying all week, some people don't like to hear this. You know, that it's important people should know that, because I've been hearing so much of this, that there was a reduction in production and pipelines are getting shut down, Bob. And, you know, people start to believe this kind of stuff. And the idea that they would believe that the president of the United States would purposefully drive up the price of gas and groceries, I think you guys in the Connecticut legislature have done a really nice job of working together. You don't get to, you know, and I said this the other day and some people got upset. The Republican brand is very toxic around the country and around the world. Not so much here in Connecticut because it's kind of a different animal. Would you agree with that?
In some places, I think that we're seeing a lot of the infiltration of some of what we see on the national level in the state, in state politics and local politics. I wouldn't want to paint that brush with everybody.
Fair.
But there's certainly an element of that for sure.
Now, this economy is in much better shape than it was just a couple of years ago. And
oh, yeah, 100%. 100%. And
good. What are you going to say? I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think again, you guys have done a great job in handling where we were to where we need to be.
Well, let's look at this for at least in the state of Connecticut. We knew 10 years ago when we saw, you know, and I actually talked about this even before that, but in 10 years ago, we started finally paying attention to the debt of pensions that had accumulated for the better part of 60 years. And so we finally started doing something about it. But tackling those issues requires a lot of hard work. It requires a lot of unpopular decisions. But it ends up building a better base and a better foundation for the state long term. We're reaping the rewards of some of those very difficult decisions that we've made over the last 10 years. We made some very deep budget cuts. In fact, our spending and our spending increases have been some of the lowest in the country. Florida has had higher spending increases. Texas has had higher spending increases than Connecticut in their overall budgets. We have the one of the lowest state employee workforces in the country. Our workforce per capita is in the same as it was in the 1950s or 60s. We've made two state employee agreements that are saving over $40 billion over 20 years. We're actuarially paying down our pensions. We have because of the volatility cap that we put in our bipartisan budget, we have a rainy day fund that is completely filled up of $3 billion. All extra money, surplus money, goes towards paying down the pension debt that's been accumulated over 60 years. We've been doing that now. We're going to put probably another $2 billion, $3 billion into that this year. So that's like paying off your mortgage early. That actually gives us some room in our operating budget, which we haven't had in a long time. So there's really good things going on. It's just it has taken a decade of very difficult steps to get there. But I think fiscally, we're doing well. If you also look at our GDP numbers, were some of the for the fourth quarter of last year, which is the latest that has come out, is some of the best in the nation.
Yep.
So let's celebrate those things. Let's celebrate the fact that people are coming back to work. We saw the job numbers today. 400,000 people, I think, got jobs over the last month or so. These are really impressive numbers nationally. And
yep.
So, you know, we ought to be talking about our, you know, I think those numbers now bring us back pre-pandemic levels. So I think the work that we've done over the last decade, I think the work we've done over the last 2-3 years in Connecticut to keep people safe, to make sure that we're doing all that we can on our economy, but taking the appropriate health measures and science measures, have all been the right thing to do. So, you know, I think I'm very bullish on Connecticut. We live in a great state. We should be proud of it.
You know, Bob, interestingly, WalletHub put out their list of the states and sort of ranking the states, and Connecticut had one of the highest tax burdens in the state. But if you look at the states on the list, it's New York, California, Hawaii, Illinois, Vermont, New Hampshire. It's the most desirable places for people to want to live. This really is a great state. Of course there's going to be a higher tax. We have to pay for stuff. You know, that there's a cost. Yeah. And people just have to understand that to have all these nice things and to have a high-functioning state, you know, you are going to – and, again, a lot of it, property taxes. We have very high property tax. We have really great houses in this state. Bob, we've got to take a quick break. I want to come back because there's something I'm dying to ask you about. Two things. We'll do that right after this on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM. I'm Joe Aguirre in for Paul Pacelli on the line with State Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff, who represents Norwalk and Darien. Bob, thank you so much for giving me a little bit of your time. Just need about.
No problem. Hey, can I just respond to the last point you made before the commercial break?
Of course, yeah.
About taxes. So I just want to mention it to you that, you know, it's true. We have, with the higher cost of living here in Connecticut and some of the other those other places that are most desirable to live. And as I say to people all the time, nobody moves to Florida for the lower crime rate, the great educational system, or the drinkable water. You know, we're head and shoulders above most states across the nation. And frankly, I had a constituent, I guess, who moved to South Carolina and telling me about how low their taxes were. And they moved, of course, after the kids were out of the house. I'm like, well, of course your taxes are low. The education system there stinks.
Yeah.
And, you know, most anybody with means there sends their kids to private schools, and voila, it ends up being the same amount of money as your property taxes. But I will say that there are things we can do here in the state of Connecticut to lower people's property taxes. One, I want to get rid of the car tax. I hate that car tax.
Oh,
and
Bob,
two,
I love that.
I hate the car tax. And then two, you know, we have 169 municipalities that do the same thing over and over and over again. And, you know, a lot of duplication, a lot of replication on these small towns. And if we can get these towns to work together a little bit better, we could save taxpayer dollars. So those are just two things that I would do to lower taxes. But there is a high cost of living here, but because there's a lot of services and people demand those services and they want good schools, good communities, they want their roads paved, all those kinds of things. That's what makes, you know, that's to keep our state one of the best in the nation.
Of course. And I could not agree with you anymore. You know, during the pandemic, I know some against Lamont, but mostly the Governor Whittier in Michigan and in some other places, some of these governors were accused of power grabs. And I don't really buy into all that, but it really got me thinking there are 30 states out of 50 where we have part-time legislatures. I talked to David Wilson, Republican, who's retiring. I talked to Russ Moore, Democrat, yesterday. Both of these guys are in favor of it. And I was like, what's the holdup? And I guess, and this makes sense because it's a very self-serving thing, Bob, but for someone to step up and be like, hey, give us longer terms and more money, that's a tough spot for someone who's active in the legislature to do. Is that a possibility that we have a full-time legislature? How realistic is that, and how could something like that happen? And what are your thoughts on that? Again, I don't want to paint you in a spot, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I mean, most people don't really even realize we're a part-time legislature. Most people think that we're just like Washington, D.C., and we make $150,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, and that we, you know, have huge staffs, and that, you know, it's we're full-time. The fact of the matter is that, you know, our session is in the odd years, which is right after the election, it's January through June. And then in the even years, it's February through May. But, you know, people think that that's the only time we work. That's crazy because, you know, it's not like I say to people who send me an email when we're not in session, I'm sorry, we're not in session. I can't help you with your problem. That's, you know, nobody would do that. And, you know, as a leader, I can tell you, our job is basically full time.
Yep.
And I'm a realtor as well. It's always a balancing act that I would say for anybody who's in the legislature. It's a balancing act because most of us have to have other jobs. And also what's been talked about a lot is the legislature has not had a raise in 20 years. It's, you know, we make the base amount that we make is $29,000. We get an unvouchered expense, $5,500 for senators, $4,500 for House members. And then you get mileage back and forth to the Capitol. But other than that, you know, that's basically it. And so nobody can have a house in Norwalk or Stamford or Darien or Bridgeport or any of those towns with that kind of a salary, which is why we all have other jobs. But it gets very difficult to balance, one. And then, two, it really does prevent a lot of people from serving.
Mm-hmm.
It does more harm than good because you have fewer voices of people. Fewer diverse voices because people just can't afford to do it. And you know, diverse, by diverse, I mean racially diverse, I mean socially diverse, economically diverse.
Yep.
You know, it's it is very, very difficult. So, you know, I just think that, you know, it's something that we need to be looking at. You know, whether it's full time or not, that's probably a debate for another day. But I do think that it is time for the legislature to have a raise in compensation, and then have some sort of a mechanism where there's a COLA every year or something like that. Because without that, you know, we've seen for 20 years, the legislature does not want to vote itself a raise because it's not politically palpable to do. So you need to have another mechanism in there that says, okay, you can at least get a COLA every year.
I think you guys are doing a good enough job right now, and with the surpluses, it's one of the reasons I've even brought it up over the last couple of days is I do feel like, you know, now's the time. And you know, if nothing else, I'd like to see 4-year terms instead of 2-year terms because, and Russ and David Wilson both said it, it seems like you get in after like a year, you're just right back on the campaign trail.
Yeah. Well, that would require a change in the state constitution. I'm not sure how the voters would feel about that, but that's, you know, I think right now we're looking to change the state constitution on no excuse absentee balloting and early voting and things like that. Maybe one day that'll come up. I mean, again, you talk to people, they all think we make $150,000 and we're full time, and they think we should all have, you know, 4-year terms.
So, yeah.
You know, I think we need to also do a better job of explaining what we do and really show people the value. I mean, we have a, you know, $22 billion budget. I'm not sure that people want folks who are just making $28,000 a year to make always make decisions on what you're doing with a $22 billion budget. You want people who can spend the time, who have expertise, who have diverse voices, who, you know, can dig into things and then make the best decision possible. But you can't do that if you're worried about you have to do your other jobs because you just can't make ends meet on a legislative salary, which you can't.
Right. You know, even restaurants were struggling to hire people for $28,000-$29,000 a year full time. It's
right.
You know, let alone, hey, run our state for that price. Bob Duff, State Senate Majority Leader, I really appreciate you giving me some of your time today. Much appreciated. Keep up the good work. I'll hit you up again in the future.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate you doing it.
Anytime.
Oh, well, then I will certainly will take you up on that, Bob. Have a great day. Thanks so much. Cast in stores now. He's a good buddy of mine. And he corrected me the other day when I mispronounced Paige Buckers.
Oh, come on, Joe.
Brian, what's going on, bud?
How you doing, Joe? Glad to be on. I've got some facts for you about the games tonight, and I'm excited about them.
Listen, if you give me your opinion on any of this, you're gone. Just kidding. All right.
Well, I have opinions, too.
All right. Don't share the opinions. I just want the facts. I kid. No, Brian, I do appreciate you coming on. I'm so excited for the UConn women. Big Final Four, 14th in a row. 14 in a row, is that right?
14 in a row Final Fours. However, an unfortunate fact is they've lost 5 straight semifinal matches. So right now, Vegas, they've got Stanford at -1.5. And UConn's got their work cut out for them. I mean, there's a lot of cool things going on about the game tonight. You got, obviously, Paige Buckers. That's Buckers.
What's that you all about? Why is that you even in there?
What's that?
Why is there a U after the B if it's Buckers?
That's a great question. One that I was not prepared to answer.
That would be an opinion for the. I wouldn't want that anyway. All right, go ahead.
So she played her high school ball at Hopkins, and that's 10 minutes away. So it's kind of a homecoming for her. It's kind of cool because Gino Auriemma loves to schedule games for his players to kind of have a homecoming game. It just so happens this one is the biggest game of their career, so to speak, so far. But UConn's got their work cut out for them, for sure. Stanford is the reigning national champion. They have a lot of size. Also, I thought you'd be interested. They have 2 twin sisters who can shoot the lights out.
You know,
Lexi
I love that.
And Lacey Hall. I know you do.
Now, listen.
Lexi's the one who you got to watch out for, though.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, the other day, I mentioned this, and just, I guess I'll let the cat out of the bag. I don't really pay a lot of attention to UConn basketball, which is why I have friends like Brian. And I was talking about, and because I had saw a lot of basketball people, including Rebecca Lobo, have mentioned, you know, maybe the key to this team is AZ Fudd. And you immediately texted me when I said that on air the other day, and you said Beckers is all they need. Tell me about that.
I'm not sure that's exactly what I said.
Maybe I've misquoted you.
You may have. They need a whole team effort. They have to play their best game of the year tonight. I know that's really groundbreaking analysis. It's the biggest game of the year. But Paige Becker, she's been dealing with an injury. She had, 27 points in the last game? But she hasn't looked quite like herself. They need to shoot the lights out tonight. Really, that's the only way I can see them advancing. And even then, who else around Paige and AZ? Kristen Williams has to shoot well. I mean, they got their work cut out for them. They're very thin in the front court now. They had one of their players go down, Dorca Juhas. She had wrist surgery. So they're lacking in the front court depth. Stanford has a really good center in Cameron Brink. She's 6'4". She can get into foul trouble of her own. If they can get her off the court, then the game really changes into one I think UConn will be more successful with. But that's one of the beauties of the tournament, is it's one and done. Anything can happen.
Let me ask you this, because obviously UConn's been great for as long as pretty much Gino Auriemma has been there. You mentioned Becker's missed some time. Is the dynasty starting to come to an end? Obviously, I realize this team's still a contender, but there was a time where UConn women just rolled through all of these tournaments for so long.
Well, if you're saying is the dynasty coming to an end, you could argue the dynasty is coming back, because Paige Beckers is the number one player in the country when she was recruited. AZ Fudd is the number one player in her class when she's recruited. I mean, that's a sophomore and a freshman right there. So the future is bright for them. They have another incoming recruit. I think she's fourth in the class, Ayanna Presley, I believe. I don't know. There's videos of her dunking the ball all over high school teammates. So, I mean, UConn's going to be all right. I think with women's basketball in general, you've seen better teams across the country. I mean, you still have the same 6 to 8 teams who get all the top players, UConn being one of them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Stanford's been good for a really long time, too. Tara Vanderveer, coach of Stanford, has 9 more career wins than Gino. They've been going at it for years and years and years. UConn's first national championship, they had to beat Stanford on their way to do it. So, I mean, they know each other well. Gino had a comment, and he said, this Stanford team looks a lot like the team 27 years ago. It's just different players, but you know they're going to shoot well and they're going to run the same things.
Brian, hang on the line for a minute. We got to do a quick traffic and weather here on Connecticut Today on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM, and more about the UConn Women Huskies. I am Joe McGuire in for Paul Pacelli on April the 1st, 9 minutes in front of 6 o'clock. Brian Forster, he is the host of In Stores Now. He is a good friend and a UConn expert. And Brian, I was just asking you before we went into the break, or actually during the break, I asked a question. Obviously, the other two teams in this final, it's Louisville and South Carolina. Neither team scores at the clip that UConn or Stanford go to. If UConn beats Stanford, what do you think of their chances of winning a national championship? Because I think they get much better against these two teams.
I don't necessarily agree with you. I think so. South Carolina, they're favored by 8 points tonight. I think they're going to run through Louisville. They are the best defensive team in the country. They've been the best team in the country all along. And they beat UConn by, I believe it was 16 or 17 points earlier in the year. Granted, UConn's a different team now than they were then, but it doesn't really get any easier for UConn if they can get through Stanford tonight. I know you called me an expert on UConn. I had to make a correction. It's Ayanna Patterson. Ayanna Pressley is a congresswoman.
I knew that, and I wasn't sure whether or not the UConn woman had the same name as the congresswoman, so I didn't say anything.
But we are good friends.
Appreciate you fact checking yourself there. So you're giving me the impression, Brian, and I know that you bleed blue and white. Do you not think the UConn women aren't going to win tonight? Is that right?
I don't think so. I hope I'm wrong. They got their work cut out for them. Because the thing is, UConn is deep. Stanford's just as deep, maybe deeper. I mean, they need to play a near perfect game tonight, and even then, that may not be enough. If Paige doesn't shoot the lights out, I mean, they have to get out early. I don't think they can afford to play from behind. You can't have a slow start. All the basketball cliches, I think, are in effect. You got to shoot an efficient percentage. It'll be interesting. It's going to be late too. It's a 9:30 tip off, maybe later, based on whenever the first game finishes. So, I mean, you could be finishing around midnight. Take a nap.
You're breaking my mom's heart right now, Brian. I definitely don't think she wants to hear that now. Again, you sort of said this earlier, talking about, I mean, when it comes to women's basketball, there's still the haves, and there's a handful of them. UConn is the only team left that's not a number one seed, had to beat a number one to get there. This when you look at the men's tournament and you look at the parity amongst all of those teams where a team like St. Peter's could go on a run, it's a little bit different. And that's still obviously great news if you're a UConn Huskies fan.
Well, I can confidently say St. Peter's women's basketball team would have no chance in this tournament.
Yes. What do you think about because I always say to my mom, we've had this conversation, a few years ago when UConn was winning all their games by 40, 50 points, holding opponents into 20s and 30s, I was like, do you really enjoy that? Is that fun to watch? That sort of dominance, that they're that much better than everybody else. And again, now they've leveled off just a touch where some of these teams are at least approaching them. But like you said, 95% of these teams have zero chance.
Well, so, I mean, this has been an interesting year for UConn because they've had so many injuries to deal with. And that's the only reason why they're a two seed in this tournament. Had they not had the injuries, I mean, they're right at the top with everyone else, like you see now in the Final Four. Sure, they beat NC State. NC State's a very good team, but no team wanted to play UConn and have them be in a two seed, especially playing at Campbell and then playing at Bridgeport. I mean, it's set up for UConn to get to their 14th straight Final Four. So here they are. Now they've got to do something that they haven't done in the last 5 years, and that's win in the semifinal game. So it'll be fun to watch. They said about the TV ratings on Monday night, only Monday Night Raw did better. So people are watching, and it's an exciting time. It should be fun.
I love that. I like that you worked in Monday Night Raw. I thought that was, for anybody who doesn't know, he's talking about professional wrestling, if you can call it that. Brian Forster, my friend, who recently got engaged, by the way. Congratulations on that.
Oh, boy. Thank you.
Yeah. And you're an Eagles fan, and your fiance is a Giants fan, and you have a dog named LT, as in Lawrence Taylor. And I don't think that can happen to a better person than you.
Well, I appreciate it, Joe, and I appreciate you having me on.
Of course. Brian Forster, the host of In Stores Now, a UConn sports podcast. Brian, thanks so much, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
You got it.